Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the heads of bishops' conferences from across the European continent focus on new evangelization and ways of bringing the church's message to younger generations. Plus, the challenges of feeding the growing population of our planet. The Australian Embassy to the Holy See hosts a conference highlighting moral responsibilities that we all share. The heads of 33 bishops' conferences from across Europe concluded a meeting in the Albanian capital this past weekend, centred on the theme of new evangelisation on the old continent. Participants at the plenary assembly of the Council of European Bishops' Conferences, or CCEE as it's known, met from September the 29th to October the 2nd. During the meeting, they met with the president of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of New Evangelization, Archbishop Salvatore Fisichella, and also met with the Albanian president, Dr. Bamir Topi, and with heads of the country's Orthodox, Protestant and Muslim communities. In a message to Hungarian Cardinal Peter Erdő, who was reconfirmed as president of the CCEE, Pope Benedict encouraged all of Europe's bishops to identify with missionary courage new paths of evangelization, especially at the service of the new generations. Noting the 40 years of activity of the Council, the Pope encouraged all the bishops to continue the work of this valuable organisation that promotes collaboration in many areas of pastoral and ecumenical activity. Amongst those attending the plenary assembly was the President of the Bishops' Conference in England and Wales, Archbishop Vincent Nicholls of Westminster. I caught up with him during the meeting to find out more about the importance of this encounter held in the former hardline communist country. Archbishop Nicholls, could you tell us something about the significance of this meeting in Tirana, also in light of next year's Synod of Bishops on the same subject, on new evangelization?
Well, every year the presidents of bishops' conferences across Europe meet under the guidance of CCEE, the presidency of CCEE. Last year we met in Croatia, and this year we are meeting in Albania. Our theme is the new evangelization, and this morning we had a paper from Archbishop Fisichella, together with a summary of some of the responses from different bishops' conferences on the topic of the new evangelization. But we are just beginning our debate on this topic now, and I think it will help bishops' conferences to understand a little more clearly what is meant by new evangelization, and I think to root it in activity rather than simply have an exchange of views about ideas.
As you say, interesting this term new evangelization, isn't it? Because from what I see from the responses to a questionnaire that was sent to the heads of all the European bishops' conferences, the feeling is that it's not really new at all, and it's almost wrong to talk about it in that sense.
I think the picture given to us by Archbishop Fisichella this morning was to explain at some depth how new the situation which we face really is. And therefore, I think in that sense, to imply that our response to a new situation has to have a certain freshness or newness about it. So he was saying, and it's not only him, other people say it too, that the challenge facing European culture, some people say civilization, has never been seen before. And in that sense, this is new. And he put his finger on the notion that the common culture today urges people, especially in the public forum, to take a neutral stance towards all religious belief. And he says that is the most corrupting thing of all, because without an engagement in the deepest mystery of human living, then actually we cut ourselves off from the very sources that we need in order to find the fullness of life.
You're talking about this new situation, the new challenges facing European culture. And yet within the setting of the CCEE there, of course, you're dealing with a huge diversity of different cultures, different contexts, Western Europe, Central, Eastern Europe. And it must be very difficult to come up with some general guidelines, some general ideas that can be applied to these very different circumstances.
Well, discussions haven't reached that point yet. I think we're beginning this afternoon to exchange the experiences of individual bishops' conferences as they move towards some sort of action. But you're right. This morning we had a quite remarkable speech delivered to us by the president of Albania. And what he said in his speech would have been unthinkable in Albania 20 years ago. He presented his country, first of all, as the home of Mother Teresa. He highlighted the visit of Pope John Paul II in 1993 as a very important moment. He reminded us that 20 years ago this month, the Albanian government reopened formal relationships with the Holy See. So he was casting Albania as a country which makes space for the great religious faiths and has a particularly important regard for Catholicism. This is a country that 40 years ago officially declared itself atheistic and in which there was no place at all for any religious faith. So we had before our eyes this morning how situations change and how different Albania is now than it was 20 years ago and how distinctive it probably is among some European countries.
Let's look at the situation back home for you in the UK. The talk about new evangelization, is there some perhaps clearer focus about whether we're talking about re-evangelizing Christians who have perhaps lost sight of the church or about those who really know nothing about Christian culture and the Christian faith at all?
Well, if I may stay on the slightly more general level first, what was interesting in the summary of responses that we had this morning was, for example, that across the bishops' conferences as a whole, there was an instinct that the family is the most important place, both to be evangelized and to be the instrument of evangelization. So in other words, I think the instinct is not to separate those two. It's not to say as if there is somebody who is going to be the evangelizer who does not need evangelizing him or herself. And in fact, what is looked for is a renewal across the whole board of the Christian presence in a new situation in many European countries. Now, I think in England, I think we are still very encouraged by the visit of Pope Benedict. Indeed, our own reflections for the anniversary of Pope Benedict bring together some of his own comments about his visit to the United Kingdom, in which he placed that visit directly in the context of the new evangelization himself. And what we have been trying to do is highlight for ourselves the key themes on which we will concentrate over the coming 4 or 5 years. And they are very much to do with the triple challenge that the Holy Father left us, which was to be witnesses to the beauty of holiness, to the splendor of truth, and to the joy and freedom that comes from a relationship with Jesus Christ. And as you can see, they hold together the relationship in faith that we have with the Lord and the process and the responsibility of evangelization. So it's not as if they can be separated and done sequentially. They have to be lived together in a growing renewal within our Catholic life.
rightly talk about the family as one of the key focuses, one of the main places where this new evangelization can take place. Your own focus there within the CCEE has been on education recently, hasn't it, as head of the Commission on Catechesis, School and University. Again, how easy is it to draw up some kind of planning or guidelines that can be applicable to such very different situations in the different countries there?
Well, the last European meeting that we had as part of the Commission on Education was about university pastoral care, and that took place last January in Munich. And I think we were able to be helpful with a number of highlights which talked about the nature of chaplaincy within the university, but also talked about the way in which the academic strands of university life are perhaps beginning to find new questions which face them in the direction of exploring the gifts of faith. So, for example, we had a physicist who directed us to the work of Francis Collins, who is one of the leaders of the Genome Project, who himself says this highly technical, highly advanced work of the human physical makeup points us to questions about the transcendent nature of man. So there were opportunities both at a pastoral end in relating to students and how students are gathered together, and at an academic end, which had common ground across Europe. And I think once we begin to look at detailed areas of activity, then some guidelines, some common ground does begin to emerge.
My thanks there to Archbishop Vincent Nichols of Westminster, President of the Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. Australian Embassy to the Holy See this week hosted a conference on the crucial economic, political, social, and moral questions connected to food security. How can we sustainably increase food production in the face of our planet's dwindling supplies of water, oil, fossil fuels, agricultural lands, and other natural resources?
The dire warnings are there because we've got to wake up fast. You know, we have to start addressing these issues as one people on one planet, not as a bunch of nations. It's a common problem, common threat to all of us. But the opportunities are marvellous.
Australian journalist Julian Cribb, author of a book entitled The Coming Famine, highlighted some of the alarming scenarios as governments attempt to feed an ever-increasing global population. Drawing on the examples of Sudan, Rwanda, or most recently the East African humanitarian crisis, Cribb highlighted the close connections between food insecurity and the explosion of conflicts, causing waves of migrants and refugees dependent on the international community for their survival. But Cribb's vision is not all about gloom and doom. He believes that if we wake up to the urgent challenges our planet is facing, there are many creative and exciting ways of responding to the demand for food that is expected to double over the next half century.
Yes, well, there's going to be 242,000 more people to dinner tonight than there were last night. And those people are going to want better food. As China and Brazil and India and so on increase their incomes, there is a demand for much richer food, more protein and things like that. So that's going to lead to a doubling in the world demand for food by the 2060s. But at the same time, everything that we need to produce that food, water, land, energy, fertilizer, fish, stable climates, money even, and science and technology, they're running out. We're not reinvesting in agriculture. We're not making the intellectual investment we need in food production to guarantee the food supply. So that's why we're seeing sharp rises in the price of food now and increasing scarcity.
Why do you think this is? There is a lot of concern about issues, for example, like climate change, about the scarcity of water, and yet it seems that perhaps people are unable to join up the dots, as it were.
Yeah, I think if you come from one of the countries that is blessed with ample food, from North America, from Europe, from Australasia, that sort of thing, you are relaxed because your supermarket is full. But let me tell you, when we had floods in Australia, the supermarket was emptied in 2 days. The urban food supply worldwide is perilously thin. You know, if the transport doesn't deliver it, those supermarkets will empty very, very quickly and a lot of people will go hungry. So the food supply is much more endangered, really, risky, than a lot of people imagine. And we need to start thinking about these problems because it takes a generation to actually deliver the new technologies that will solve them. It's going to take 25 years to distribute a lot of these technologies around the world, for example.
It seems like somehow an almost insurmountable problem. What are you suggesting as perhaps the solutions that we should be taking today, not tomorrow, but today?
Well, we can all inform ourselves about how to eat more sustainably, and we can all eat more lightly. That's the easiest thing that individuals can do. At government levels, you've got to conserve your agricultural resources, your landscape and your water. You've got to stop your water going to the city or your water going to big mining companies or something like that. You need it for food production. We can reinvent our cities so that they recycle the nutrients and the water that they currently waste and the food they currently waste back into food production. And that will make sustainable cities in the future.
You're talking about the fact that this kind of education should be going on right at the junior school level with our children, aren't you?
Yeah, we're going to have 8 billion human beings living in cities who will never, any of them, have trodden on a farm in their lives. And if they send the wrong signal to the world's farmers, the farmers will grow the wrong food and they will damage the agro-ecosystem that produces it. So we have to educate these 8 billion people. And I want to see a worldwide... every single junior school on the planet have a year of food in it, in which every subject that you study, whether it's mathematics or sport or sociology or geography, you learn a little bit about food and how precious it is and why you ought to respect it and conserve it instead of throwing it away and wasting it like we do now.
There's also a question of these richer countries having serious problems with food-related diseases, isn't there? I mean, this could be an issue that should concern us, even though we don't have the same problem of food security.
Look, half of Westerners now die because of what they eat, okay? Half of us die from heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, and stroke. Those are all food-related diseases. They are related to the diet that we're getting from the modern industrial food system. That has to change because the most expensive thing in our government budget is healthcare. Okay, it's the biggest blowout. So that it's leading to this massive over-expenditure on health. We can address this simply by eating lighter, more healthily, more fresh vegetables, that sort of thing, and you can reduce the toll of degenerative disease.
We're talking about this in terms of economic and social issues, education issues. It's also a moral issue, isn't it? A crucial moral issue.
Well, you know, human beings for the last million years have survived because of thrift. They were sparing and careful with their food. We lost that in the last one to two generations. We are the first generation in human history not to respect our food. So, yes, there is a very big moral issue here. To recover our respect for food, to recover our thrift, because that is a basic human survival tactic. You know, it's been used, as I say, right through human history. People were thrifty with their food. They stored it carefully. They cleaned their plates, as our grannies told us, you know. So we need that to rearm morally in that sense, you know, to rediscover some of the old virtues and make them new virtues, make them fashionable again.
Do you see the churches or faith groups more generally playing an important role in rediscovering these virtues, if you like?
A hugely important role because they are the moral leaders. I think they can inspire people and they can make this look like a new thing. You know, it's not like something out of the deep human history. It's like something that we all need to do now in order to survive into the future and to avoid conflict and things like that. So, yeah, I think there's a great opportunity. But the churches are also about education. They're about sharing knowledge. and human understanding, and they're also about reducing the risks of conflict. So there are many roles within this for the church, as we go to feed ourselves. That's why I say this is the greatest issue, the greatest challenge facing the human race over the coming 100 years.
You're talking about this question linking food security and conflict. Can you say something about this, perhaps in connection also with the current crisis in the Horn of Africa?
Yeah, the current crisis in the Horn of Africa is a classic example where you have a cycle of famine leading to war, which leads to more famine because the seed corn gets eaten, the farmers get killed, people get angry with one another because they haven't got enough food, so they start fighting again, and it goes round and round and has done for about 30 years. That's a good example. A lot of dreadful wars like Rwanda, Darfur and so on began with arguments over food, land and water. Two-thirds of the conflicts worldwide that have happened in the last 25 years had an argument over food, land and water at their root. So if you can secure the food supply, you can significantly reduce the risk of armed conflict. Food brings peace. That's the message.
It's a message that it's difficult to get across because politicians are looking at the very short term, aren't they? How can people, perhaps ordinary people, in their supermarkets, in the pews, be more proactive in trying to make these connections?
Well, I think we all want to eat for more healthy, a more healthy diet. And in a way, if you do that, you are actually lightening your footstep on the planet. So those two things go together. Healthy eating and sustainable eating are both going to send a better signal to our farmers what they should be growing and how they should be growing it. So that's an important thing. We can change little things that we do in our own lives. The other thing is that through the internet and Twitter and things like that, there's a wonderful conversation going on among consumers all over the world who are rediscovering the delights of the farmers' market or growing their own or something like that. So some of the old virtues are coming back as a new fashion among the educated middle classes, admittedly. But middle classes have a tendency to drive successful revolutions. And I think this is going to be a successful revolution.
So you're quite hopeful, in fact, despite the dire warnings that are contained in your book.
Yeah, the dire warnings are there because we've got to wake up fast. We have to start addressing these issues as one people on one planet, not as a bunch of nations. It's a common problem, common threat to all of us. But the opportunities are marvellous. We're going to discover 23,000 plants that are edible, but we don't eat them at the moment. So the diet is going to be wondrously more exciting and richer and more interesting and more healthy in future than it is now. So there's a lot of great things to be done in this space, and a lot of enjoyment and pleasure to be got from it, as well as sustainability and peace.
Journalist Julian Cribb there, author of The Coming Famine. Well, also speaking at that conference was Argentinian Bishop Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo, Chancellor of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. He talked movingly of the moral responsibilities of all people of faith to ensure a more just distribution of the gifts of creation, stressing the way the popes over recent decades have spoken out consistently on this in the international arena. We're talking here about this crucial issue of food security. How important an issue is this? How much of a priority is this, do you think, for the Church today?
But according to the Magisterium of the Popes, especially of Pope Benedict, it's a very central issue. Because if we have this great quantity of people that don't have enough food, this is a real drama. And I remember Paul VI, when he speak in the United Nations, he say the most important drama, for the humanity today is this incredible quantity of population that not have enough food or don't have good food. And he say, he ask to the people, and the people promise to the poor. This was in 1964, I don't remember. The people promised to the Pope that with the money that have in the reduction of the arms, give this money to the population that need. But, of course, was a promise that was not applied. For all these reasons, if we pray, the central prayer of our church, the prayer that Christ has given and learned bread. We ask to have the bread, our bread, not my bread, but our bread, the bread of the people. Of course, this is not only the material bread, but it's the bread of the brain, the culture, and it's the bread of the Eucharisty, say the fathers of the church. But anyway, beginning with the bread, the material bread, and I think that is, for this question, is central. It's central for the Christian. It's in the gospel. It's in the pride that we ask to God. And this pride is our profound will.
As you say, Pope Paul VI, he was talking almost half a century ago about the urgency of this problem, and yet we seem unable to convince our politicians, our leaders, that this really is the top priority, that money should perhaps go from defence budgets into feeding and educating people.
Yeah, this is a real question, that maybe the politicians are convinced, but maybe there are other needs apparently more immediately, and especially for in the rich countries, because in the rich countries is not this terrible need of food at the moment. And for this reason, we can not have the practical priority. We have in the theoretical priority, and the politicians, we can justify for this reason. But in the end, this is a problem, because the great migrations that don't want the politicians is because don't have food. And for example, it was very interesting that this revolution, Arab revolution in the north, the statement was, we need justice and food, justice and food. If these people have justice and food, or more justice and food, the migration are not enough. This is a real question that don't understand the politicians, that the consequences immediately are also in his rich countries. This is the question. For this reason, I think that the ideas of the popes, or the magisters of the church, that beginning very, very the last times, but especially Pius the 11th, Pius the 12th, Paul the 6th, and especially Benedict, with his very different appeals, but clear in the sense of international justice. And especially his last message to the German politicians that say, what is a country if have not justice? It's a robbery. This is the idea of Saint Augustine. And he quoted many times this idea. And we can say, what is the world if we don't have justice? If we don't have that the people have the more important need, that is alimentation. It's a robbery.
You work very much on these issues at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences,
well, the academy,
at the academic
level. For many years, work in these issues. It's very clear. It's a central question of the gospel.
Argentinian Bishop Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo is Chancellor of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences here in the Vatican. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus. Thank you.